All right, so I gave a pretty much complete answer yesterday to this sum of Hermitian matrices question, that giving a minimal list of inequalities that constrains the spectra of one matrix another and their sum. So first, I'm going to talk today about the more interesting question, the quantum marginals problem. And here we've got HAB is a Hermitian matrix on a tensor product space, and HA is the trace of HAB over B. So maybe I should say in matrix terms what that means. So so what does my Hermitian matrix look like? HAB. Okay, so I can go down that far. I'll do it over here. HAB is a sum, I guess, of some. Oh dear, I'm not very good with bra and ket notation, and yet I know that's. Okay, good. If anybody wants a definition of this, you can ask Mary Beth. NHB, the same thing on tracing over A. And then the question is, what's the relation between the spectra of the one on both and this one and that one? So I want to give you an example of some inequalities that must hold, and just to see that it's controlled by the same sort of structure as we had yesterday, that having these magic subspaces that let you prove things using the Hirschfeld inequalities. So let's say that there exists let's say there exists subspaces W inside A and V inside B, such that W is, so I've got several conditions. I'm going to have W be in some particular, and I don't really care to say what the dimension of W is, so I'll just call it in W, be in a particular Schubert position relative to HA. So remember what this means. It means that we're looking, HA defines a chain of subspaces on A, where you add the eigenspaces go in decreasing order. And we look at how much W intersects those subspaces and see where the jumps occur. And I is recording the pattern of those jumps and the dimension of the intersection with W with those subspaces. V is also going to satisfy some condition. I mean, for any, this is a, you could say, take this as the definition of I. You could say, pick W and V, and then let I be the unique pattern of jumps that is one can calculate from W. So, I'm going to put all this all together and then state an inequality, and you can say, well, maybe I pick the W and V first and figure out what the IJKL are, or I pick the IJKL and then I hope that a V and a W and V exist, which is closer to what we actually do. Okay, so those are familiar from yesterday, except that we have two of them instead of just we had one magic W yesterday and it satisfied three conditions. So far these are completely independent, but now I want conditions on W tensor V. So this lives inside A tensor B, and I want to say where it lives. Dim W, dim V, A tensor B, and there's that minus again, like we had with the minus H, minus H lambda minus H mu. Okay. And W tensor B plus A tensor V. We can figure out what that dimension is of A tensor B minus HAB some fourth guy L. So one thing that's interesting to note is that this space contains this one. Actually, each one of these two spaces contains this one. This smaller space is the intersection of these two larger ones. But let me just put an inequality here to say that this one contains that one. So I'm thinking now about a chain of two subspaces here. And what that's going to force actually is that where the jumps occur for the larger space will include where the jumps occur for the smaller space. If the dimension is jumping up with the smaller one, then it'll jump up for the larger one also. That's right. So these are both subspaces of the same vector space, A tensor B, and I'm just taking everything I can make by adding a vector in here and a vector in there. And it's not a direct sum because these two share this. Yes?
You just mean that when you say W tensor B, you just mean the identity
of U? So W tensor V, so W is a subspace of A? W tensor B. I'm not talking about operators here. I'm talking about subspaces. So, and we'll see in a moment where I need to make that crucial distinction. Okay, so if we have that, which we do, if you pick any W and V, then there will be some IJKL. If you pick IJKL, then there may or may not be some magic W and V doing what you want. But if so, under this situation, then summing over I, let me let this denote the ith eigenvalue of A. So I'm just a I've got a lot of matrices to take eigenvalues of, so I'll just use that. I add those eigenvalues, and I add these eigenvalues. That'll be bounded above by adding these. A, B, and now there's that annoying dim A, dim B. B minus plus 1 minus K, like we had before, and also same with L, but minus L.
So E is now the density matrix or Hermitian matrix?
Sorry, these are eigenvalues of HA, of HB, and of HAB. So I should say, then for all HAB with marginals HA, HB. This inequality holds. So let me rewrite the right-hand side just to say you can think about this slightly differently. I'm summing over I equals 1, not, maybe I isn't so good. How about M up to dim A, dim B. And I will include the mth eigenvalue of AB, or properly speaking, the dim A, dim B plus 1 minus mth eigenvalue times 2, 1, or 0. 2 if this guy shows up in both sums. Now, remember that big L contains big K, so if it's in big K, then it'll be in big L too, and we'll get it twice, and we'll get coefficient 2. So that's if M is in K. We'll get it once if it's in this sum but not that one. So that's if it's in L but it's not in K. Then we'll get it 0 times if it's not in L. So just to say, the inequalities as written here look a lot like the inequalities from yesterday, and the derivation is going to be very similar. But it's nice that we have eigenvalues plus eigenvalues, less than equal eigenvalues plus eigenvalues. The only thing that's a little different, and I'm emphasizing here, is that if you put everything together, you can get coefficients more than one. So they end up looking different when written everything together, but the derivation actually does. The derivation only sees coefficients on eigenvalues because the same eigenvalues appear in several different places and they're being added together. So the proof is the following. Let's take the projection operator onto W and tensor it with the projection operator, the identity operator on B. So this is, now I'm writing an equation on operators, so I will be once I have this here. And I'm going to add to that operator the operator 1 on A, tensor, projection onto V. Okay, so, I'll say what the actual answer is when you add these two together. You can write that instead as projection onto W, tensor, projection onto V, plus projection onto that funny thing, W tensor B plus A tensor V. Okay? So let me draw a picture to try and convince you that of this statement. It's a very simple statement, really. If I pick bases of A and B and write these down, then this is going to be an equation on diagonal matrices. So I'm going to draw just the diagonal of those diagonal matrices. How big are those diagonal matrices? They are dim A by dim B. So I'm going to draw a very scary picture of a diagonal matrix. This is my picture of the diagonal of a dim A times dim B diagonal matrix. I'm only going to write down the diagonal entries. What are the diagonal entries? In this picture, I only use part of A and I use all of B, and my diagonal entries are 1 up here and 0 down there in my diagonal matrix that I've just drawn a picture of. Okay. Similarly here, I use all of A but only part of B, and I get that. Here I use only part of A and B, and I get that. And here I use the union of these two, and I get that. So there are the diagonals of these matrices. Say of these diagonal matrices. Okay? So, in both cases, what we really have is 2, 1, 1, 0. Written these two different ways. Now we take that, so multiply by HAB and trace out both A and B. So what do you get? On the left side, if I multiply by HAB and I first trace out B, then I get, I still have to trace out A, pi W times HA. And here if I trace out A but leave B in abeyance, I get pi V on HB. And here I just get what I get, trace of the whole thing on A tensor. I still have to trace on both of them, HAB on the projection to V tensor W, and finally trace of A tensor B on the projection to that complicated space. W tensor B plus A tensor V. Okay. But now I can apply Hirschfeld to these four. I can apply the Hirschfeld inequality that we had yesterday to these four guys. That these two are greater than the terms on the left-hand side. Whereas these two are less than equal to the terms on the right-hand side. And that's it. Okay. But again, what was this about? It was, we have some IJKL that we want to build an inequality, and the inequality is only really notices what IJK and L. It says you add these eigenvalues from A plus these eigenvalues from B plus these eigenvalues from AB with these funny coefficients determined by K and L. Is there a W and a V that do the job? Well, for certain IJKL there are, and for certain IJKL there aren't. Yesterday I told you how to answer that. I didn't prove it, but I told you how to answer that for Weyl's problem, and said there's this magic way to do it using puzzles. I shouldn't call that magic again, since magic is a technical term now, I suppose. There's this very pleasant way to do it using puzzles. Here there is not. There is no corresponding known way that's as nice as puzzles. So I'll tell you the best that we do know in the next lecture. What I want to do right now is two things. I want to tell you how a generalization of this to get more such inequalities, and with really the same proof, and then I want to tell you when you should expect that a question has a solution given by linear inequalities. Because lots of interesting questions to ask, like if I have HABC and I know the spectrum of HAB and HBC, or what are the conditions between the three of those one does not expect to have, and does not have, linear inequalities in the solution. The solution is more complicated than just a bunch of linear inequalities. So I want to say when things are, you might consider easy or trivial, and when they're not. Though even finding out which IJKL occur here, I wouldn't say is easy or trivial. Great. So first thing I wanted to say, generalization of this. And really, I just want to draw the following picture. Let's say I have this diagonal matrix on the left, and also this diagonal matrix. Then I can instead write that as this one plus this one plus, let's see, I want to go three steps up, and right, plus this one, and there's a couple more terms. You can get the left side, so this guy is itself, this one plus this one plus that one. You can get this left side if you have not just a single W inside A, but you have a chain of subspaces inside A. And you add the projection operators onto those chain of subspaces, and you'll get this diagonal matrix. And if you have the same thing inside B, you'll add those chains, you'll add those projection operators and get this diagonal matrix. But then you can rewrite that as projection operators in the tensor product onto this chain of subspaces and get a similar, and derive a similar inequality. But you get many, many more such inequalities for many more such chains in A and B. Oh, yes.
But are they independent of the other one?
Sometimes. Yeah. I'm not going to make a statement here about exactly what the list is, and I'll leave that to Sasha in his lectures. All right. So a framework that leads to problems with, or that leads to linear inequalities. So what these three problems have in common, where we were thinking about the diagonals of a Hermitian matrix, or you're thinking about the spectrum of the sum, or you're thinking about the spectrum of the marginals, they have a common framework. They all come from each one corresponds to a choice of a pair of Lie groups. So first we have a pair H and G of Lie groups. So what is a Lie group? I don't really want to say much about what Lie groups I'm thinking about. So I'm just going to say it's enough to think about unitary groups, or maybe products of unitary groups. Those are the only groups I'm going to be considering. And there are other Lie groups out there. So these are, instead of thinking about the group of unitary matrices, you could think about the group of orthogonal matrices, or you could think about the group of upper triangular matrices. And those are other examples of Lie groups, but the only ones that are relevant for us are for the three questions I said are unitary groups. And what I want is, I want H probably to be a subgroup, or maybe I'll just have a map from one to the other. And the examples that we've talked about correspond to the following three things. We'll have the group of n by n unitary matrices, and inside there we'll have the diagonal matrices. which is part of, so the diagonal unitary matrices. And what does the diagonal unitary matrices look like? It looks like n copies of one by one matrices put together. So this is why one reason I need to talk about products of unitary groups as not just unitaries themselves. And the next example is that my big group will be UN cross UN, and inside there I'll have UN sitting in this symmetric way, which is that it's going to consist of the pairs of unitary matrices that are equal, right? So sitting inside as this, what's also called the diagonal, though I'll try to not to use that word to be too confusing here. And the other one I want to think about is I'll have the unitary group on A tensor B. Maybe I'll just call it UMN. And mapping to there, I have UM cross UN. And this is the one where this map is not actually one-to-one. This is not actually a subset here. And why is that? If you take a scalar transformation here, then it'll do the same. Scaling your first vector space is the same as scaling your second vector space. So by the time you're here, you can't tell which side you were scaling. So that's the only way in which this thing fails to be a subgroup, because you're killing off the distinction of who's doing the scaling. So you could, for example, you could get much closer if you dealt with only determinant one matrices, and then there's not as much scaling to be done. But I'm not going to really care about the fact that this isn't a subgroup. So let's leave it at that. So these are going to correspond, as it turns out, to the Schoenhorn Weyl and quantum marginal problem. Yes.
I'm hoping that you're implying, but you haven't really said it yet. Are these conditions necessary and sufficient?
I don't quite understand the relation between these conditions and the known necessary and sufficient conditions. So these are certainly necessary. I'm not sure that all of the sufficient ones are of this form. I kind of doubt it. I think probably a little bit more would have to be done to this would have to be generalized a bit, I think.
But you are going to set that H, A, B, these specifications are polygonal.
That is true. That the conditions are linear inequalities, yes, even if these aren't all of them. Yeah, so this is so far I haven't stated what problem to ask given H and G. And I'll need a little bit more. I'll need a little bit more to do that. So I can talk about a group acting on itself by conjugation. And so how does that work? If you have two group elements, then I'll define dots. I'm defining it right now to mean that. Dot does not mean multiplication. Juxtaposition means multiplication. And so this is how I have the group act on itself. And you might say, well, that's a boring thing to think about nearby the identity. It doesn't go anywhere. But there's more going on because we're thinking about continuous groups. You can say, well, if it's taking the identity to itself on the nodes, then it's taking things that are nearby the identity to nearby the identity. In particular, it's taking things that are infinitesimally close, that are just the identity plus a little tangent vector. It's taking them to other tangent vectors. So no, this is not boring. what we find out is that G acts on the tangent space to 1 in G. And I'll write this as Lie of G, Lie algebra. And I don't care that this is an algebra. I only care that it's a vector space. It's a tangent space. So don't be frightened by this name, because I'm not going to use the algebra structure at all. But now I've got this action. So what is that in the case of the unitary group? Since that's the only case we really care about, is that, so if G is the unitary group, then the Lie algebra is the skew Hermitian matrices. So if you've never thought about that before, the statement is, if I have the identity plus a very small matrix, so I'm very nearby the identity, what does it mean for that thing to be unitary? It means that that times its star should be 1. Right, but this thing is 1 plus epsilon m plus m star plus something too small to even talk about. For these to be 1, I want this to be 0, so it needs to be skew Hermitian. And if you read very old physics books, they talk about the Lie algebra being Hermitian matrices, because they couldn't bear to have something have all imaginary eigenvalues when it seems possible to have it all have all real eigenvalues. But they have given up on that, and thankfully they are now in the mathematician's camp and embracing it honestly for what it is, skew Hermitian matrices. All right, so, and then how is it acting? Well, it's acting like this, that we know how, if you take a skew Hermitian matrix conjugated by a unitary, it'll again be skew Hermitian. Okay, and what I get from that I'm really going to need, is that G acts on not the Lie algebra, but its dual. And this is called the co-adjoint action. So this is called the adjoint action. This being out on the dual space is the co-adjoint action. So how do you think about that with unitary matrices? If G is UN, then I'm going to identify the dual with Hermitian matrices again. So how's that supposed to work? Well, the dual is supposed to be something that eats skew Hermitians and gives you a real number, right? That's what it means to be an element of the dual, is mapped to the real numbers. So how that's going to work is, if I have some skew Hermitian, if I have some Hermitian matrix, then I want to turn it into something that eats skew Hermitians and produces real numbers. So I'm going to multiply the skew Hermitian by the Hermitian, take the trace, and then multiply by I. There. Now that's automatically a real number. So the details of how I'm identifying it aren't so important. You should just think, okay, so now we've got unitary group acting on Hermitian matrices. And how does that work in the more general framework is really the co-adjoint action. Where in a more general framework, you might not have some silly rule like this to give you a handle on things, and you might sort of more honestly work directly with the dual vector space. But here, of course, this is good enough for us. Okay. Now, because we have H going to G, we therefore have the identity going to the identity. under a group homomorphism. And so that means that things that are nearby the identity go to things that are nearby the identity. You know, it's continuous map from H to G. Differentiable, really, is what I want. And so I get that the Lie algebra maps to the Lie algebra. And therefore, I get the thing that I really want, which is that the dual maps backwards the other direction. Okay. And what's a... Yeah, okay. So what this does is we can take G orbits in the coadjoint space and project them to the coadjoint space for H under this map. And ask which H orbits are in there. So let's think about that in our three cases. So example one, we've got the Lie algebra of UN mapping backwards to the Lie algebra of U1 to the N dual. And this we identified with Hermitians, and this we identify using the same rule with diagonal Hermitians. Which is to say, Rn. And this map ends up being, if you follow this through, this map is take the diagonal that we had in the morning yesterday. So the taking a Hermitian matrix and stripping out, looking at just the diagonal part, is an example of one of these maps. And what did we do? We said, given an orbit here, which is to say, given an isospectral set, inside here, we had one of these guys, O lambda, which was the Hermitian matrices with spectrum lambda. But you could also think of it as we start with this matrix and we apply UN to it and see what are all the things that we get. We started with that, we projected it into here, and we asked what diagonal matrices do we get. But now I'm going to ask it slightly differently. I'm going to ask what diagonal matrices do we get. No, I'll just say that. So this was an example. We recover the Schur-Horn problem. Okay, so that's an example of this. Any questions for a good example?
Looking at it this way, give you a better or simpler solution than the Schur-Horn sort of nuts and bolts?
Well, of course, the history is that Schur-Horn did this, and then people were inspired by that to come up with a big framework, and that I'm explaining now. So, I guess I would say it isn't simpler, but it's better packaged. I mean, if you can internalize a few, even if you don't really worry about the proofs, you can internalize a few basic theorems about this framework, and then it's really easy to say, oh, that's an example, Schur-Horn's an example, and to say, I expect to get a polyhedral answer, and even in this very special case, to know clearly what the polyhedron is. So if you insist on knowing the proofs all the way down, then no, it's not really any simpler. But I think it is a better presented in generality. Any questions? All right. So the next one's going to be this inclusion. So we get this map backwards and from Lee of UN dual plus Lee of UN dual back to Lee of UN dual. And so we want to think, what is this map actually? So this was the transpose of the map that just takes a matrix to the matrix written twice. And so let me write down an equation that might help somebody compute that transpose. So here's the matrix of this map. V goes from V to V, where V is a four-dimensional space. Okay, and now I'm going to transpose that, and I will get this. And what happens, instead of a vector going to two different places, two different vectors go to the same place. And this is all to say what this map is. It is somebody in here and somebody in there goes to their sum. So that's, of course, what we're interested in the Weyl problem. And you can ask, if you have an orbit in here of the group UN cross UN, which is to say you've got O lambda cross O mu, then inside here, which orbits will you hit? Which O nu will be in the image of that? And that's the Weyl problem. And example three, I promised you, was the quantum marginal problem. I'm not going to go through the same sort of calculation other than to say that we'll get a map from the Lie algebra of UMN to that, dual, that of M and N. And it does just take HAB to the pair HAHB. And so this general problem becomes, in that special case, the quantum marginal problem. So in this generality, we first get a theorem by Gilliman and Sternberg from a long time ago. And it's what they prove is more general than what I'm going to say here. But let's just say implies that for any, okay, well, I, sorry. Let me say it the following way for the moment. For any H and G, and let me let H very definitely be a product of unitary groups, A1 cross A2. So that I understand what the answer could look like. So their statement is for any pair of groups, but it requires introducing cartons, Weyl chambers, positive roots, or something. So I don't want to do that. So that's why I'm going to restrict to only talking about H being a product of unitary groups, where I can describe the answer better. So for any such pair, and we had this map, if we compose, I've got an orbit inside Lie of G dual. Okay? And I project that to Lie of H dual. And then I take, so this is a tuple of Hermitian matrices. Right? Or how about I call them? H1, H2. Right, we identified that with Hermitian, with a tuple of Hermitian matrices. And then I take the spectra. And what I end up with is I end up with a list of A1 decreasing real numbers and A2 decreasing real numbers and so on. Okay? So if you start with a coadjoint orbit of G living inside here, and you first say, well, let's project to here, what you have in here will not be a polyhedron, right? That already you could consider H being G, being SU2, and then this looks like R3, or H being G being U2, I should say. This looks like R4, and the coadjoint orbit will be a nice round sphere. So you don't say that the image in here is a polyhedron. You have to take the spectra first before there, that's the polyhedron. So the statement is, compose these, the image is a convex polyhedron. Okay. So they don't tell you what the convex polyhedron it is. They do have a nice theorem from 2 years earlier that if H is commutative, so which is true in example 1 but not 2 or 3, if H is commutative, then they can tell you not only is this a convex polyhedron, but here are the vertices. And it's a very nice little theorem. I don't think I'm going to state it for any particular reason. So in this case where H is not commutative, then they can't tell you what the vertices are, and there isn't really a very nice answer to that. Any questions right now? Yeah?
So if people care about low dimensional K, they just look in the structure of the B by B unit matrix to see how to code this kind of thing.
Sure. Okay, so what I'm going to start to explain and say more about this afternoon is how to determine the inequalities on this polyhedron. So I need to introduce another problem you can associate with a pair of groups. And I'm going to solve, or I'm not going to, but I'll tell you who did solve this problem now, in terms of that other problem. And then that one will be yucky but computerizable. And I'll explain how to do that in the afternoon. But first I need to introduce another problem that's, of course, going to relate to the existence of these magic subspaces W, and reduce this one to that one. Okay, so there's another problem associated to a pair of groups H and G, which is, okay, so we had G was acting on the dual of its Lie algebra, and inside there we had an orbit, which in the Hermitian matrix, in the case of G being UN, was matrices with spectrum, Hermitian matrices with spectrum lambda. Okay? So, here's a fact. The smallest H orbits, and by smallest I mean smallest dimensional, the smallest dimensional H orbits on O lambda are themselves isomorphic to, so maybe I'll put a G here to be clear where that guy lives, are themselves isomorphic to coadjoint orbits for mu. Now, we have a Morse decomposition, and I should tell you the name of that decomposition again. It's the Bruha decomposition. Of this guy and this guy. So how did we do that? Well, we had these Rayleigh traces, and we talked about gradient flow, and we broke up these spaces into pieces according to where things flowed down, and the pieces then had this easy way to describe them. A subspace W was inside a given stratum of that decomposition if it intersected this flag a whole lot or not very much. You could say, so there were some intersection conditions that told you where you were. But whatever that was, there's a decomposition of this and a decomposition of that. And you can talk about a point in here being being in some special position relative to Hermitian matrix Hermitian matrix M. And you could ask, well, if it's in here, is it also in a special position for another Hermitian matrix for this smaller guy, H? All right. So then we can look for strata on the big guy and the small guy that intersect in finitely many points. So these points would be the W of the Schur-Horn problem, or the pair WV of the, not the Schur-Horn, of the Weyl problem, or the W and V of the quantum marginal problem. And in my last minute, I'll give a very vague statement that we made very precise in the afternoon. So the theorem and the relevant theorems here are by Bernstein. Notice this is not Bernstein. It's also, there's, of course, mathematicians with both names. And this is this one, Bernstein and Shamar in 2000, and an improved version by Nicolas Rasser in 2007, is that every inequality On these polytopes can be blamed on one of these finite intersections. And part of what Rosser does is enough to take one point intersections. So I told you yesterday, if you have for the horn for the vial problem, if you have a magic subspace W, then you can use it to prove inequalities, and or you can use it to prove an inequality. And actually, you don't need you only need the case where there's only finitely many W, and even there, Belcalli proves the better thing. You only need the case where the W is unique. And Bernstein-Schmar didn't prove that, and Rosser did for this general problem. So I'm going to tell you in the afternoon this unpleasant, clunky way, but rigorous and computerizable, to actually calculate those when you get an intersection and how many points there are in the intersection. And I'll make it very explicit in the quantum marginal problem. So, till then.